Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome to this unusual meeting of ASEF, where everybody has been going in from their home location. We have a shortened program to make this all doable, but we want to continue doing business as usual as much as possible, which is, of course, not as normal. But we thought it was a good idea to have our meeting in a shortened format. And we're going to begin our conversations with a brief discussion of the IBER reform proposals, which is one of those proposals that really need to be going through, given the urgency for especially the banking sector. I would like to give the floor to Illyriana.
Yes. Thank you, Hans. Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us today to talk about IBOR reform phase two. When we decided to bring this paper to this particular ASEF meeting, we were aware that by this time we would not have published the exposure draft just yet. Given the expected short comment period for the upcoming exposure draft, we thought this is a good time for us to discuss the main board's tentative decisions. So really the purpose of this session today is to take you through some of the key board's tentative decisions in this project, and then hand over to you so that you can share your preliminary views and any comments you might want to make us aware at this stage. So last time when we talked to you about IBOR reform in October last year, we were discussing the preliminary scope of the project. Since then, the board continued to develop its proposals, and just last month in February, the board concluded the discussions for IBOR reform. The exposure draft is expected to be published in the next coming weeks. And if everything goes as planned, the target for issuing the final amendments is the third quarter this year. Slides 4 and 5 provide just a bit of background on the IBOR reform itself and the project, but I, given you are all familiar with the project, I won't go into details on those slides, but we'll jump straight into slide number 7, which sets out the scope of the project. So the areas you will see in the slide are the areas that we had discussed with you last October, and then each area has the topics that the board discussed and took decisions on. I say in a nutshell, there was no significant changes not much changes at all for that matter compared to the scope we had discussed with you in October. Slide number 8, I'll move on to that now. And that slide provides an overview of the proposals for modifications of financial assets, financial liabilities, and lease liabilities. So the board tentatively decided to amend IFRS 9 to provide a practical expedient so that entities can account for changes required by IBOR reform by simply updating the effective interest rate prospectively. So an entity moving away from IBOR to an RFR can simply do that by updating the EAR going forward. Applying this practical expedient, the entity will not have to do the assessment as to whether the changes required by IBOR reform result with derecognition of that financial instrument, and there won't also be no modification gain or loss at the date that the changes are accounted. We refer to changes required by IBOR reform as those changes that meet the two conditions that the board set out. Firstly, that The first condition being that those are changes that are required as a direct consequence of IBOR reform, and the second condition being that those changes are done on an economically equivalent basis. For all other changes that an entity might make simultaneously to, in addition to changes required by IBOR reform, those will be accounted using the existing requirements in IFRS 9. So aiming to provide a consistent accounting for changes required by IBOR reform, the board also amended IFRS 4 to allow insurers that currently apply the temporary exemption from IFRS 9 to access the practical expedient we just talked about. IFRS 16 was also amended so that leasees can account for lease modifications required by IBOR reform using a similar practical expedient. So that's slide number 8. Moving on to slide number 9, which sets out the main proposals for in the area of hedge accounting. I was not going to go into details of each of the proposals in this area, but maybe it's worth emphasizing that the proposals in hedge accounting follow the same theme, if you like, to that of the modification. So if an entity has financial instruments designated in a hedging relationships, then moved from an IBOR to an RFR, then the board's tentative decision is that that entity shall amend the hedge designation so that the hedged item, hedging relation, hedging instrument, and hedge risk can, where relevant, can refer now to the RFR. And doing that change won't result in a discontinuation of hedge accounting. Similarly to what we said for modifications, if there are other changes to the hedge designation, then those will simply follow the existing hedge accounting requirements in IFRS 9 and IAS 39. I think it's worth to mention that all the requirements with respect to measurement and reporting hedge ineffectiveness remain unchanged. So that's hedge accounting. Slide number 10 then sets out the proposals for disclosures. In the course of developing these proposals, the board considered a range of factors, including talking to users to understand the needs their needs for information in the context of IBOR reform, and in the other hand, bearing in mind the preparer's concern for the additional cost that preparers might incur in preparing these disclosures. So that's the disclosure set out in slide 10. And slide 11 sets out the proposed effective date, which is for periods beginning on or after January 1st, 2021. The proposal for the retrospective application of the amendments. And this retrospective application would also mean that entities will reinstate discontinued hedging relationships if those hedging relationships were discontinued because of the reform, due to reform, and they wouldn't have been discontinued if the amendments we're talking now were in place at that time when the discontinuation occurred. So that's all I wanted to highlight in terms of this pack, and I'll pause now and give the floor to you so that you can share any comments or questions you might have.
Okay, I open the floor.
It's Chiara here, yes, if I may. Yes, we appreciate the speed of the process that the staff and the board have put in place for this phase two of IBER. We confirm the urgency of finalizing as planned these amendments. From our side, we continue to support the execution and the endorsement in time for application of the reliefs for the approval of the annual reports 2020. So we will replicate the approach that was adopted last year for phase one. So it's for this reason, we particularly appreciate the delivery of these amendments in this draft already now in April. And this is also why we have put in place a somehow innovative process. Our preliminary pre-consultation document has been already issued on the basis of the tentative decisions of the IASB. It will be replaced by the draft comment letter as soon as feasible. We support the detailed contents of all the decisions. We had a long discussion about the clarification that missing a contractual amendment, a change in the calculation of an index is treated as a modification. So we appreciate that this, we support that these changes ring-fenced to the IBER solely. So, but this is supported on the basis of the urgency to complete the amendments. So I think that we will discuss again if the board plans to reopen this subject in another project, because some of our members do not see the need to discuss this topic. But for the rest, we are absolutely supportive of the process and of the contents.
Okay, thank you, Chiara. Who else?
If I may, Friedrich Hauser on behalf of AOSG members, and I would...
Yes.
Thank you. I would echo Kiara's comments on the support that came from the outreach we did with the AOSG members, and commending ISB to progress with the project, even in the current circumstances, given the importance and urgency, as well as the fact that the sweep issue has been dealt with as a narrow amendment, because there are views that further implications will have to be worked through over a longer period of time in terms of the modifications beyond the reform. While members did support generally the proposals, they had some minor considerations for clarification, which I'm happy to share with the staff outside the meeting, but just to run through a few of them if you want. In some of the staff papers, there was a reference to the change in the calculation of the benchmark as an example of the change of the directly related or the changes related directly to the reform, but there will be some benchmark rates that are being changed, but not necessarily as a result of the IBOR reform as defined in phase one. The classic example is the PBSW rate in Australia, where there is a change in calculation, but it doesn't necessarily revert to the risk-free rates. The other one was whether the change in the reset frequency that doesn't match tenor anymore, whether that would result in a modification that is still economically equivalent and can be for, can be used in a practical expedient. Other comments were on the 24-month period for the separately identifiable risk component, and ensuring that the rationale for that period is clearly documented in the exposure draft. I think in the staff papers there was 12 months period, which was then changed during the board discussion to 24 period, and I believe it was to match the regulatory reform timeframes. Another comment we have seen was the request for clarification that replacement and or rollover strategy will be available to the modifications in the context of the reform that will result in substantial modifications. And again, some comments in the staff paper may have been understood in a way that any changes in the context of the reform would not satisfy a rollover or replacement strategy, regardless whether they are substantial or not. And then last but not least, there was a comment around disclosures. One of the objectives of the disclosures is to provide information about the extent and nature of the risks. However, while there was a specific requirement in phase one to disclose nature and extent of the risk, it doesn't appear to be carried over from into phase two requirements. And the question then arises whether it's needed for phase two disclosures.
Okay, thank you very much. Who else? Anybody else?
Back of my hand, Anthony.
Yes, Anthony, yes, please.
Okay, yeah, I just had to go back to the point that Chiara started with on the proposed clarification that changes to underlying calculations are a modification. When we first heard that was going to be included, we were very much against it because it is too significant an issue to try and deal with in a project which is urgent. You want to run as smoothly as possible. It goes a lot of interpretations of the standard that have been made consistently by preparers for a number of years. So I think it is a very dangerous precedent that's been set in such a short period. Now, given the urgency of the overall set of amendments, then okay, I think you may find some people will say, well, because you've ring fenced it, we won't have an argument about the clarification. You've ring fenced it, so we don't need to worry. Well, I would still worry because I think I think you've got to be wary of is just because people this time round, respondents this time round, don't get into an argument about that element because it's been ring-fenced and they don't want to disrupt the current process, that can't be interpreted as being they support that clarification. So I think we have to be very careful that such a significant, potentially significant amendment isn't taken to be an acquiescence about it just to get the overall package of amendments through, isn't seen as agreement with the proposal. I don't think it's a clarification. I think it does significantly amend the way people have applied the standard for a number of years. And I also fear that right now it may cause a concern. So there could be situations where in 2019 there have been amendments to underlying calculations that do relate to the reform, but the exemption isn't yet available. Where it wasn't treated as a modification, and preparers are incorrect. So they might even so this might indicate, even in the narrow area of changes to underlying calculations as part of IBOR reform, errors were put through the accounts in 2019. So I would say our response is going to say our first request would be just to remove the clarification and let's have a robust debate about it later, because isn't doing anything in the amendment. It's clarifying and then being ring-fenced. It's having no effect whatsoever. So our first option would be to remove it. But in the second case, if it's not removed, please do not take people's acquiescence as an indication that they agree with the clarification. It's just because it is having an impact right now and they want the package there. Just a couple of clarifications. I mean, just on the 24 months, just to be clear it needs to be clear when do those 24 months start counting? Because will an individual preparer effectively be able to set their own clock running on the basis of the decisions they've made, rather than there being a consistent 24-month clock for everyone? I think the preparer actually sets their own clock running, and that might have some incentives on the dates in which and preparers actually make the change to their underlying hedging instruments and hedge items. So just be careful that it's clear how that works and what the implications will be. I'll leave that.
Okay, thank you, Anthony. Sue, you wanted to come in?
Maybe just on the last point first, and then I'll talk a little bit about the modifications and changes in calculation methods. So in terms of the 24 months, I think it should be clear in the document that the proposal is that that 24 months starts running from the date when a new hedge, when the hedge is adjusted for the new designation. So it will depend on the timing of the adjustments. So it will be clear, and people can comment on whether they agree with that or not. In relation to the modifications, I completely understand the concerns that were raised around the proposed change to say that a change in calculation, even if the words don't change, is also considered to be a modification. Because of those concerns, we decided to limit the scope of that amendment to just IBOR reform at this stage. There's no way that we would assume that if people agree with it for this document, that we're going to assume that that means it's okay for a bigger project. I mean, I can completely assure you of that. The reason why we decided to limit the scope was to make sure we had time to think of any other sort of unintended knock-on consequences. And because some of the points people were raising about the clarity of how big the adjustment needed to be were fair points, and we didn't want there to be sort of unintended consequences. So we'll look at that carefully. Having said that, just a couple of other points to add. I think from a standard setting perspective, if you have exactly the same economic consequence between changing the words in the contract or not changing the words in the contract, but having a fundamental change in how the numbers are determined based on the mechanics behind the scene, so the economic outcome is equivalent, I find it very hard to let the form of that modification change the accounting dramatically, which is why we think we do need to look at it further. We need to make sure that it doesn't have unintended consequences, though. The other point that you touched upon was the consequence for somebody who's done something different. That's why we're proposing that it has retrospective effect. My understanding, but it will be interesting to get confirmation of that in the feedback process, is that most people who have already decided to not treat this really as a modification now have sort of done the accounting that's proposed in the ED anyway. So I think we're going to get sort of by a long route back to what people have already done in practice, but we'll be making it clear that that is the allowed / required accounting. So I think if people are, you know, look at it clinically, they won't be unhappy with where they land. And so I guess I'm just asking people to do that rather than to react sort of to the optics and the emotion of it.
Okay. You.
Okay, thank you, Chairman. On behalf of our financial instrument team, I would like to share some of our comments. Just now, our colleague from Australia representing the LSSG already mentioned some comments from China. In addition to that, I would make some one or two additional comments. Generally, we support the proposed amendment in the ED for IBOR Phase 2. Currently, we just have some suggestions on the disclosure, that is on slide 10. First one, as the colleagues in Australia mentioned before, that we suggest having some requirement to disclose the nature and extent of risks arising from IBOR reform, because in slide 10, the amendment D require entity to disclose how the entity managing those risks, but didn't specify what are those risks. So we think that it would be easier for stakeholders to understand if the amendment could clarify that what are those risks. That's the first point. The second one, we also noticed that in slide 10, the amendment A and D are both related to how entity manage and adjust the risks arising from IBOR reform. So may we suggest that maybe it's better to combine this disclosure requirement to simplify this requirement. That's the second point. The last point is regarding Amendment B in slide 10. That's more like a clarification, because B saying that the current amount of financial assets and financial liabilities should be disclosed. So we just want to clarify that in addition to that, other information, for example, the gain or loss on the derecognition on substantially modified financial instruments due to IBOR reform also need to be disclosed. That's our comments on the disclosure. Thank you.
Can I maybe quickly respond to some of the points?
Yes, Rihanna, please.
Thank you. So just to touch on the comment you've made about the nature and extents of the risks that need to be disclosed and that it was required in phase one, I think similar to what Frederica said. The phase one disclosures are still, of course, in effect. So people still need to do the phase one disclosures in addition to what they now have to do for phase two without duplicating information. But I guess, you know, I can see that maybe there's a situation that somebody may not have had hedge accounting relationships affected by the reform, but they are within the scope of phase two for some of these other changes, and therefore that requirement may not necessarily apply to them. So it's something we can look at during the feedbacks period when we look at the comment letters. And just on the your other question around the gains and losses on the derecognized assets or items that have been significantly modified, the existing disclosure requirements in IFRS 7 still applies. And there is a requirement to disclose the gains and losses on assets that's been derecognized. So the phase two disclosures are really just in addition to what is in IFRS 7 already. So we haven't taken away any of those disclosures, and people still need to comply with them in addition to doing the phase two disclosure. So the information should ideally still be provided by people. Thank you.
Okay.
Hans, can I speak?
Yes, please.
Hi, it's Linda. Just a couple of comments. We were not able to meet with the banks, but we did get some early review from them following the project. The one comment I want to reiterate that Chiara already made is the timing is critical. And I think most of you know that in Canada, our big banks actually have an October 31st year end. And they are very anxious to see these amendments in place. So we will be working very hard to get it actually into our literature as close to October 31st as possible. So the timing is crucial, and we will do everything we can to assist you in keeping to your timeline. There are a few comments that they have shared with us, and I think, but wasn't able to fully confirm, that some of these are in light of the fact that they have subs that are following the US GAAP guidance, and they're thinking about it in that vein. But the few things that have been mentioned there's a bit of a concern about some of the disclosure requirements, the extent, and they're looking at those now and are anxious to see the final words. They've also brought up the notion of the reliably measurable criterion, and in the stage where a new rate is coming on stream and is gaining liquidity, and whether or not people are going to be sensible and use judgment in terms of getting to reliably measurable. And so whether or not the words change, or you just encourage people through your communication activities to be sensible and use judgment. And in that same vein, some of the concern, there is some concern that for a period of time, some of these calculations could amount to level three disclosures under IFRS 13. And while that should be a short period, again, encouraging everybody to be sensible and use judgment. So big picture comments, those are the ones we were able to glean from talking to the big banks in Canada. Thanks.
Liliana, did I see you want to get in?
You're on mute.
Hello?
Not now. It was I think you raised a point about disclosure in point B, and I just wanted to clarify that that is saying disclose the carrying amounts of assets and liabilities and nominal amounts of derivatives that still reference an IBOR that is yet the entity knows it's either been discontinued or will be discontinued. So it's really just to give an indication of how much is yet to transition. Hope that clarifies okay. that.
All right, thank you. Who else? No.
Yes, thank you, Hans. Financial institutions in our jurisdictions have told us that for certain hedging instrument relationships, the hedging item and the hedging instrument will transition to different new reference rates. And therefore, at least temporarily, there will be a mismatch between the two new reference rates. And these financial institutions are asking for relief even after the hedging item and the hedging instrument have moved on to a new reference rate, because it is uncertain how this mismatch will be resolved. And we think this issue is not unique to our jurisdiction, and we'd like to understand whether the ISB has any plans to discuss this issue. Thank you.
I guess, can I ask you a question, Nobu? I mean, how would we do that? So that is something that people have raised from time to time, a concern that there may be mismatches in timing, and so for a period of time, at least, there could be two different rates. But would we have to sort of have some sort of expectation that they're going to ultimately move to the same rate? How could we ring fence it? I think that's what's caused us to really not propose going there. And there is an economic mismatch.
Yes, thank you very much. So what we've heard so far is that there may be two scenarios. One is that there will be some kind of swap that will swap between the two. So there'll be an introduction of a new derivative that will bridge the two. But even so, they don't want discontinuation of the hedging relationship. So that would be one way to think about it. The other is that there will be some, we don't know how, but at least one rate will move to the other so that they eventually converge. But at least for the time being, there will be a temporary period where they would have two different rates. So under that scenario, the banks are asking us to allow for a re-replacement type of relief, to say that you can re-replace it maybe once or twice during a certain period, so that if it all comes from the same IBOR reform.
Okay. Do I see anybody else that wants to? I see Wihon, Korea, please.
Thank you, Hans. We agree with the direction of the board's proposal, and we support making the amendments as narrow as possible to limit them to the direct changes resulting from IBOR reform. We also support the amendments being made in the form of practical expedience, because the process for the amendments needs to be expedited to align with the pace of developments being made in the market. I just want to make two comments. First, I think it'd be very important to provide guidance as clearly as possible as to what constitutes modification directly required by the reform and on an economically equivalent basis, because I assume that there will be cases for which it is hard to determine whether a modification is made on an economically equivalent basis. I understand it would be impossible for the board to consider all potential cases resulting from IGO reform and comprehensively prescribe which cases are modifications made on an economically equivalent basis. But I think what the board needs to do is to clarify the meaning of economically equivalent basis by referring to some practical examples that could be debatable. Another point is about 24 months, as a few members already mentioned. I think it'd be necessary to provide a clear rationale for why the board specified 24 months. Without further explanation, it would appear arbitrary. So I think at least the board need to provide a rationale in the basis for conclusions. Thank you.
The short answer to that is we do provide a rationale and the basis, but we acknowledge that it's arbitrary. So the rationale given is really to be practical, to allow a reasonable period of time for markets to settle. But at the end of the day, 24 months is just a number. So it's really a question of what's reasonable in the circumstances.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Oh, Cédric? Cédric?
Thank you. Well, from the first echo that we received from our stakeholder in France, we are very supportive of the project and direction. We have just gathered at this stage a comment regarding disclosures, the paragraph B in your slide, regarding the disaggregation of amounts based on the indexes, because it's information that is not directly gathered, collected in the systems that may require large development. More broadly, the requirement to provide extensive disclosures on an exception or process that is supposed to have no impact finally is considered to require it. Thank you.
Okay. Do I see anybody else? That is not the case. So thank you for this exchange. I think our staff heard some worthwhile comments. So we are now moving to the next item on the agenda, which will be an update on agenda planning. Michelle, do we need to change staff?
Yes, we do need to change staff. So I think Deho should be joining us. And then in And then in terms of ASAF members, it's Raymond.
And I will drop off. I think Dr. Zavari is going to represent AOSG going forward, number of topics.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you and have a good day.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Mr. Shijwari, Nobu, EH, Yushen, Chiara, Patrick, Alberto, Anthony, Rodrigo, Russ, and Linda.
Okay. Excellent. All there. Okay. Yes. Dehao.